need a new excuse to dominate the world. Therefore, let's just say we're doing it on benevolent humanitarian means, and then we can go kill a bunch of poor people. And everybody will cheer us on as heroes. And it works fairly effectively. Now, in terms of the Arab Spring, which you mentioned, this was, I like to go to Brzezinski, actually, to explain sort of the situation that rose up, because for over a decade, Brzezinski has been talking about this term he uses called the global political awakening. And what it essentially means is that for the first time in all of human history, mankind as a collective is politically activated, socially aware of vast social and economic inequalities, and they're becoming mobilized and motivated. And that this is predominantly driven by educated youth in third world countries. Brzezinski went around to all the major think tanks in the United States, Council on Foreign Relations, in Canada at our equivalent, in Britain at their equivalent, at warning the elites that this is the reality we have to deal with. You know, he called the war on terror a mythical historical narrative. He said, this is the reality, the global awakening. We have to direct policy on this issue. And in 2005, the Council on Foreign Relations came up with a report promoting democracy in the Arab world. And Madeleine Albright was one of the chief authors of this. She was also a student of Brzezinski's. Back in the day, he oversaw her thesis and brought her within the Jimmy Carter administration. So she owes her career to Brzezinski. And she authored this report promoting democracy. Of course, it's the American version of democracy, where it's called essentially liberal capitalist democracy, where you have factions of elites separated into political parties, and they vie for power, then they just serve the American empire whenever they get power. And so the only difference is that they're a little more stable than dictatorships, which was the problem, because dictatorships were, they no longer had a good reputation, etc. It was increasingly difficult to control their populations who had access to global communications, internet, etc. So the idea is promote liberal democracy to make the system more secure for them. One of the central facets of the report from the Council on Foreign Relations was to promote evolutionary, not revolutionary change. Now, in terms of the Arab Spring, a lot of this, I think it's a, they were starting to prepare for the inevitable in the sense of they were sending in their nonprofits, they were trying to contact dissidents, other groups, helping to organize them. This was the case in Tunisia and in Egypt and certainly elsewhere. But the change, the spark in Tunisia just happened so suddenly. I mean, if you go back to the event when it happened, the media ignored the Tunisian uprising almost entirely for about a month. And the French actually tried to actively suppress it, giving arms, weapons, even threatening to send in soldiers. And then the line sort of changed quite quickly. And it's sort of this balancing act. While they were trying to get into what they call civil society groups via funding organizations, NGOs, and many other organizations which can't exactly be called NGOs because they're quasi-governmental organizations, they were establishing contacts, but it seemed as if they weren't exactly ready, so it's still a very unsteady situation for their interests. You look at Egypt, they tried to have, ensure that their guys get in, but there's protests still continuing to this day. There's many different interests at play, many different people, many different ideas of change, and so the process of managing these changes is very difficult, but it's a vital necessity for the American empire to try and control this. Or you have the Libya option, which is to just go in and commit blatant warfare. Or you have the Bahrain option, which is to tell Saudi Arabia to go in and ruthlessly oppress the uprising. After all, the American Fifth Fleet is located in Bahrain.
Right.
And you can't have a democratic uprising there.
I only have a slight difference with you there that I don't think the U.S. asked Saudi Arabia to go in there. I think the Saudis did it as a brushback because they were pissed at Obama for bailing on Mubarak in Egypt.
Well, that's also quite likely. There was also, I think I read in Al Jazeera it was, but there was an agreement, tacit agreement, for the Arab states to support the Libya invasion if Saudi Arabia could get a green light to go in.
Yes, I think that came out of the Gulf Council.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because, of course, the African Union did not support it. And the no-fly zone on Libya prevented the African Union peacekeeping mission from landing and attempting to reach a peace agreement with Gaddafi. So that essentially made that a self-fulfilling prophecy. But
also, Libya, we employed the humanitarian intervention model that you attribute to Brzezinski and that is alive and well in the Obama administration. And I didn't want to interrupt you, but I did want to just echo your comments about Zbigniew Brzezinski, because I think he is as much an American rogue as Henry Kissinger, yet he skates. You know, very little blame is laid at his feet over the botched policies of supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and the blowback that has clearly occurred from it. And he still is invited on television to offer his comments as if, you know, he is America's most brilliant foreign policy advisor.
Well, it's because, in a sense, he is. And this is because, I mean, the comparison with Kissinger is excellent, and it's one that's been drawn quite a few times. He's the Democrats' answer to Henry Kissinger.
Absolutely.
But one thing I have is that, or one perspective I have on that one is that I actually think he's far more dangerous and far more intelligent than Henry Kissinger. And this is because Henry Kissinger, he's sort of a mover. He makes things happen. He was infamous for his back-channel diplomacy, having sort of secret networks through which you would communicate with other governments and manipulate as many governments as humanly possible. And he was quite good at it. And he still is good at it. I mean, if you, Bob Woodward revealed, I think, in 2006 that of all the outside advisors going into the Bush White House, Henry Kissinger was the number one person who was in there advising on Iraq policy and et cetera. So he has been, you know, sort of a constant strategic imperial advisor for several White Houses. But so has Brzezinski. Brzezinski was even brought in as an advisor to Bush Sr. He's advised nearly every single, I believe, every single president in some capacity since Jimmy Carter. And the difference between them, I see, is that while Kissinger is more of a mover in terms of making things happen, establishing diplomatic channels, Brzezinski is more of a thinker. He's the one who steps back and looks at the system more accurately and sort of advises particular policies which deal, from an imperialist perspective, more effectively with the system. I mean, if you read Kissinger's writings, the man doesn't come off as particularly intelligent in any capacity. He has nothing to say that hasn't been said by hundreds of academics, and his rhetoric itself, it's all very uneventful. But Brzezinski, actually, if you listen to what he says, it's profoundly important in terms of understanding not only the imperialist mindset, but the policies and the strategies. And he's always been ahead of the game for the imperialists, and that's why they love him so much, and that's why he's put up in the media as a statesman, because all these people are promoted as statesmen or Albright stateswoman. You know, generally the view is that, the view I have anyway, is that you never get the title of statesman or stateswoman unless you have millions of deaths under your belt, because that generally is the way that it works. You know, it's like Madeleine Albright is a brilliant stateswoman. You know, that's how she'll always be introduced on CNN or whatever. And, you know, this is a woman who on television was asked a question about the Iraq sanctions having killed over a million Iraqis, 500,000 of which were under the age of 12, and she was asked the question, is it worth it? And without pausing, she just says, yes, of course it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's just, you know, that's sort of their mindset. It's a means to an end, and the end is always worth it. And Brzezinski is far more adept at identifying these changes. And I actually, if go back to his 1970 book, Between Two Ages, it was the foundation for the creation of the Trilateral Commission. which in turn helped shape what we call globalization. So Brzezinski is essentially almost an ideological founder of the concept, modern concept, of globalization. Henry Kissinger can make no such claim. Brzezinski, on the other hand, you know, attracted the interest of David Rockefeller, who said, we need to make this idea happen, and created the organization, and promoted this, promoted these ideas, and was very effective, and it still is quite effective. But Kissinger is sort of, you know, he remains in strategic circles, but Brzezinski is very much on a different level, I think.
Well, I want to move on to another topic. This is fascinating, and we could go on at some length. I'll just wrap by saying that the American people deserve to know who our former secretaries of state and national security advisors actually work for. Because it surfaced that Albright and Jim Baker, the Bush family consigliere, were both on the payroll of the nation of Kuwait. At the time, we were trying to renegotiate the reparations that Kuwait owes to Iraq. Or I guess it's the other way around. We imposed reparations on Iraq to Kuwait, and Bush W. was trying to renegotiate that. And he brought in Albright and Baker, both of whom were paid advisors to the Kuwaiti royal family. And I don't know who else Albright and associates work for. But at minimum, when these people are trotted out on television, we should know who they're working for. And the American media never discloses that.
No, of course not, because that would be getting to truths about who the American media works for, and getting to truths about how power in the American system and the global system function. And that's just not a pathway that the media is willing to travel, because they would be, you know, putting a noose around their own neck if they did that. So just promote them as, you know, intelligent individuals who spread democracy and freedom around the world, and now they're just commenting on new ways to do that.
We're talking with Andrew Gavin Marshall here on The Boiling Frogs. Andrew, another part of your work that attracted our attention is the in-depth reporting and analysis you've done on the role of major foundations, notably Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie here in the United States, on policies, on the education system, and they are quite pervasive. And they also fund NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that purport to be, at least to some extent, counter-establishment, I wouldn't say anti-establishment, when in fact they're often just extending the work of government with a slightly different facade. So take a couple of minutes here to talk about the historic role of foundations that came from the plutocrats of the last century, and the way that money continues to trickle down and influence American culture and society.
Yeah, I think that foundations and philanthropy are one of the least understood and most important subjects in the modern world. And they play a central facet in my current book that I'm working on. And as I mentioned earlier, in terms of discussing American history in the 19th century and social upheaval, radical ideas, even rebellion and potential for revolution, this was the context in which foundations arose. Now, as you mentioned, the plutocrats of the last century, the robber barons. So you had the Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, etc. They were challenging the old elite as they were rising up through the Industrial Revolution. Now, the universities that predate America, Harvard, Yale, etc., they produced at that time, generally, it was religious education to produce gentlemen. That's the phrasing that's used. But the industrialists decided to create new universities to promote the development of social sciences, what they called social sciences. And the idea was that they need to produce a new elite to manage society for their benefit, because while they were extracting the resources, controlling the country, dominating politics, and creating massive wealth for themselves, they were creating also massive social upheaval. So they needed to create a more effective system of social control. So, you know, you had John D. Rockefeller founding the University of Chicago, Cornell, Vanderbilt University. These were all founded by robber barons and industrialists. And then they started to institutionalize ideas of social sciences. And the notion of the social sciences, in particular, political science, economics, and sociology, were to take intellectuals away from social critique and potentially leading populist or radical movements, talking to people. You don't want intellectuals talking to people. That's bad. You want to institutionalize them, make them talk to each other, and support each other, of course. And the idea of social sciences was that you would create social managers. So people who would seek to, yes, critique the system, but you focus on the symptoms, not the causes. Because, again, you don't want radical change. And then they promote reforms to the system to make it more secure. So that's the concept behind economics, political science, sociology. And then the foundation sprung up in the early 20th century to really take on this cause and really promote it. The Rockefeller Foundation was actually founded in the midst of a huge scandal for the Rockefellers themselves, because there was something called the Ludlow Massacre, which was an event where miners in Ohio, I believe it was, went on strike at a Rockefeller mine, and the Rockefeller family paid the National Guard to go in and get rid of them, and there was a massacre, and women and children were killed in tents, and it created a big scandal for the Rockefellers, to the point where they had protests in New York City in front of their offices. And this is where public relations came from, because the first PR man, Ivy Lee, was hired by the Rockefellers to promote the Rockefeller view of things. So you had public relations find its origins there. That, of course, became a force unto its own. And then the Rockefeller Foundation was created, initially handling this issue in order to create ideology, to construct new ideology. So the foundations are essentially engines of social engineering. They function mostly on two planks. One is creating consensus among the elite, so to bring the elite together, to establish consensus in terms of ideas, ideology, philosophy, actions, initiatives. So these foundations created think tanks. They fund the think tanks, like the Council on Foreign Relations, like the Bilderberg Group, like the Trilateral Commission, Carnegie Endowment, etc. You name the think tank, and it's foundation funded. And then the other, and of course, establishing consensus also involves the educational system. So you shape the social sciences. You shape the fields of political science. You shape what knowledge itself. And the Rockefeller Foundation, which was founded in 1913, and the Carnegie Corporation, which was founded in 1911, worked together to create what's called the Social Science Research Council in 1924. This was to act as an intermediary between the foundations and the universities, so that in their so that it did not look as if the foundations were overtly redirecting the social sciences. So the SSRC was involved in establishing new ideas for the social sciences, changing the curriculum, changing the direction. And, of course, all the leadership was, you know, drawn from the boards of these foundations themselves. But that's, of course, you know, just incidental. But so they shaped the educational system itself, so that how people, you know, who go through the education, and like myself, I study political science in school, and it's just designed to train future elites, to train people to properly manage the system. You don't want them to understand the system. And if you just look at the education system itself, it's segregated. Like, why would you have politics, economics, and sociology separate? These are interacting, interrelated, interdependent concepts. They can't be separated. And the study of one of them as separate from the other is absurd, because not only do you not understand the system as a whole, but you don't understand that aspect itself, because it's not separate. Politics aren't separate from business and economics and finance and society. They're all interrelating. So you create they call it specialized categories, but I call it indoctrinated and segregated. And then the other main way through which the foundations engineer society is through creating consent. And this is where the NGOs come in. The idea is creating consent to the system, to the social hierarchy which exists, atop of which the philanthropists sit. And to do this, they have to essentially, a lot of this involves social movements. So what they do is they, you know, if there are movements for change, which are inevitable in any socially disparate and segregated society, they start to fund these organizations. Now, a lot of them are called social movement organizations. For example, the civil rights movement. And the idea was that as the civil rights movement, you know, started to grow up from the 50s into the 60s, the foundations became very involved in funding. They funded all the various organizations. Although what they decided to do was they give more funding to organizations such as the NAACP, which they also helped found, by the way, which promote legalistic reforms to the system. So they deal with the symptoms. So they deal with the symptoms of racism, not the causes, not the root causes. And so the idea is that you change laws, you allow for African Americans to rise within the system, that is what civil rights is about. So they support those organizations. And when Martin Luther King, in the last year of his life, started speaking out against the Vietnam War, started speaking out against the American empire, economic inequality, and poverty, they didn't like this very much. And then his organization, after he was assassinated, essentially got zero funding from foundations. They don't like revolutionary ideas. What they do is that they steer social movements through their funding. They organize them into organizations, and in today's context, this is NGOs, non-governmental organizations. So with the anti-globalization movement that sprung up in the 90s, they fund the NGOs, and these are often, you know, perfectly admissible ideas and people who really want to affect good change, but they become, again, this is where the my concept of ideas and institutionalization come in, because they become institutionalized.
Absolutely. Actually, I call it they get to be neutered.
Absolutely.
They truly neuter them. And I think in some ways it becomes an oxymoron because, as you said, these let's say they have the NGOs that are supposed to be government watchdog.
Yeah.
Or corporate watchdog. And first, with becoming 501c3, because they say, great, we have to go and get this tax-exempt status, right? Well, who gives you the tax-exempt status?
Of course.
The government, and they think it comes free. Because once you gain that status, you have committed to so many rules and regulations that basically neuters you, okay?
Yep.
And you're partially neutered just during the first step, then you become tax-exempt because... sure, you don't give tax from the donations you get, but you cannot talk about, let's say, if you want to advocate for a certain political movement or a political leader or, let's say, libertarians. You can't do any of those stuff. Your hands are tied during that first step. The second step is the funding, and these are, you know, let's say with government watchdog organizations and these so popular whistleblower organizations who've been around for over three decades, the biggest one being Project on Government Oversight, mm-hmm. they get millions of dollars from the exact same entities. You know, it's the Rockefellers and Carnegie and Ford, and you have Soros now, one of the newer ones. And you go to the next year, another whistleblower organization, you see the exact same people funding them. Then you go to the next one, let's say it's called OpenTheGovernment.org. I mean, these are all great-sounding organizations, NGOs, and as you said, they started good,
yeah.
You know, with some good people who were idealistic, and they said, imagine what we could do if we had funding, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure, we'll give you funding, and the government says, we'll make you tax exempt. Here are the rules for the funding, and here are the rules for being tax exempt. And also, we put our people on your board of advisors, board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
So the ideals and the objective, they get to be quickly replaced, or actually they stay there as a cosmetic mission statement.
Yeah.
And they do is absolutely, as you said, they create consent, and they don't watch. It's the opposite. They are there to protect the system.
Absolutely, and even the psychology of, you know, the leaders within these movements, that is dramatically affected, because they may start off as radicals, revolutionaries, wanting to just change the system entirely.
Exactly.
But when they become organized in institutions and professionalized, and foundations really aim at professionalizing social movements,
right.
Because what happens is that they are given status, they become elevated, they have good income. They make sure that these people are, you know, they become well off.
Absolutely.
And they're invited to think tanks, they're invited to international conferences, they're promoted in the media, they meet as so-called stakeholders to, quote, speak for the people at international conferences with governments and corporations and international organizations.
Right.
They are literally brought within the very structure of empire itself.
Absolutely, and I would also add incestuous to that, too, because let's say that the government watchdog community are looking at tens of organizations, right? The same funders, the same tax exam status, the same directors, whether it's POGO or often the government or various these really nice-sounding organizations, they actually associate only with each other, and they support each other's work. And when they see any kind of an outsider trying to, you know, come up with a more so-called radical, let's say, whistleblower movement or others, they actually gang up as one big family.
Of course, you need to isolate and segregate.
100%. We went through that. I mean, there were 150 of us, the government whistleblowers, and they made sure that we would not be quoted in any media coverage, for example, that dealt with the national security whistleblowers from various government agencies, even though when the topics were about these whistleblowers, they made sure that nobody from this group, the whistleblower themselves, are not being quoted. Well, because the whistleblowers are not savvy. You know, they sound radical. And one trademark, it was very interesting what you said about the psychological change that takes place. They start talking in these sentences that usually starts with, well, there are no clear answers. You would say, well, you know, this office, like, well, actually, it's not that bad. Or, well, actually, to make it that, okay, the problems are not, we have to talk and dance. There are a lot of kissing going on in the Congress. You have this illusionary kind of maybe confrontation, but it's all kind of for the purpose of illusion, for show only. But behind the scenes, you make sure you don't touch any hot button issues. You know, it's amazing, and the media is part of it. And this is one of the issues: the media is being part of it. And we want you to talk about a little bit about this media aspect of it.
Even in terms of alternative media.
Exactly. Actually, they are the ones that are my target, because the alternative ones, when I started going to them, I ended up seeing the same people, the same Carnegies and Rockefellers and Soros.
Well, absolutely, because they have to fund the alternatives. You must control the opposition. You know, this is essential. That way you control the discourse. And that is the most important thing. So, you know, you have Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, Soros, et cetera, funding, you know, Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, funding Ralph Nader, funding all sorts of alternative news and information outlets. Because, you know, it's very clear that the mainstream news is totally inadequate, so people, you know, will drift to alternatives, so control the alternative. Yes, they can critique things more, but do just make sure they don't get to the root of the issue, control their financing. And grants from foundations come with tons of strings attached.
Absolutely.
They state what the money is for, and often they state what the conclusions are to be. So it's not just do some research and figure out what's going on in this capacity. No, it's find out how this happened and state the conclusion and fill in the blank.
Let me jump in and offer a couple of comments. I've worked with nonprofits that received funding from the Kellogg Foundation, and once Kellogg funded them, Rockefeller came in, and Ford was right in line behind them. And the program officers at these foundations talked to each other, And they're like insurance companies in a way, where no one entity wants to take the entire risk. But once one of them is on board, the others will generally follow suit. And your comments are correct. It is a series of golden handcuffs, because the 501c3 structure of the IRS does very sharply limit the ability of these nonprofits to become advocates on public policy or in elections. And so it's very circumscribed exactly what work you can do. And finally, I just want to add that when you become dependent on this money, they do very, very carefully control your budgets. You have it to get $300,000 from the Carnegie Foundation, you have to submit your budget. And if you make a change of more than 10%, you have to submit a change request. And so it gets right down to the line items in terms of how you can use their money. So I just wanted to affirm the comments each of you have been making from my own personal experience.
Absolutely. And it's I have a great quote here from Harold Lasky, who is a political theorist and economist in the early half of the 20th century. He was referring to the influence of foundations over education. He stated that the foundations do not control simply because, in the direct and simple sense of the word, there is no need for them to do so. They have only to indicate the immediate direction of their minds for the whole university world to discover that it had always meant to gravitate to that angle of the intellectual compass. So where the money goes, the results show. And, you know, it's if the foundations say, we want this subject to be covered, we like these ideas, then all of a sudden these alternative media outlets and other institutions which want funding will suddenly say, well, we want to do that, so how convenient. Give us your money and we'll do exactly this as you wish. And so the influence is subtle yet incredibly profound.
Well, and the term they use is outcomes, all right? You in order to qualify for a new round of funding, you have to show outcomes of how the money was spent before. And the outcomes are usually pretty explicit. We changed attitudes on breastfeeding or, you know, whatever the issue happens to be.
Quarterly report.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same idea. So you don't support social movement organizations that promote really radical or true change, because that takes time, and because the results can't be studied on a quarterly report, and so they promote, you know, again, the reformist treat the symptoms. And there's a great analogy that's been drawn to understand specifically NGOs in today's context. But you take a look at the missionary societies of the age of formal empires, so the great European empires. You know, the missionary societies were very much a part of the imperial project. They essentially created consent among those the empires wished to dominate. They spread new ideas, dismissed their old ideas, religions, beliefs, and allowed for the empires to come in and control these people and control their land. And so NGOs essentially act as modern missionaries in the globalized world, because what they do is that even with people with the best of intentions who join these societies, and many of the missionaries themselves had the best of intentions, though the people at the top knew exactly what they were really intended for, just like the NGOs, they're filled with people with great intentions, but they ultimately go around the world treating symptoms, which essentially, you know, you provide some education, you provide health services, some food, etc. It's very symptom relevant, but you do not try to change the structure, the root causes of, you know, you're not questioning why is there a lack of education, why is there excessive poverty, why is there no food, why is there no health care. You're not seeking to change, to ask those questions and change the results. You're just treating them. And that makes the system more secure, because it pacifies people against active resistance, against saying that the system is wrong and needs to be changed and let's change it, because you acclimate them to the system. And, you know, like I was saying, how I'm in political science, people within political science who, and of course economics and other areas, who want to change the world for the better, who see the system as it is and say this isn't right, this isn't good, and these are amazing people, they tend to go into the NGO world. They don't want to go into politics because they know it's all corrupt and ineffective, but they tend to go into the NGO world. So it's like this giant siphon for good intentions that actually just establishes more consent to the very system that it's seeking to change.
Well, and the philanthropists know that their fortunes are a magnet for people who want to do good but don't have their own means to address those problems. And so it does become a kind of perfect form of co-optation.
It's down to a science, I guess you could say. And there's literally, it's very hard to identify any facet of our modern society which has not been affected in part or in large part by foundations, from the very structure of our cities themselves. Foundations were behind the ghettoization of black Americans in New York and in other major cities. They have shaped the field of psychology and psychiatry. They have influenced the environmental movement, they have influenced every social movement. They have shaped the education of third world elites all over the world, in Africa, Latin America, Asia. Their influence is incredible to study, especially since it's so well documented. But, of course, you don't learn about this in school. Mm-hmm. Because they control the education system.
And Andrew, with this in mind, I want to finally turn to a list that you prepared of a 12-point proposal mm-hmm. for the Occupy movements across America and around the world. And your first 2 points relate explicitly to this. Mm-hmm. Maintain your financial independence and do not accept support from philanthropic foundations. So we got to credit you for being consistent.
Well, that's a good thing. But yeah, absolutely. Like those are, if the movement has any intention of remaining grassroots, remaining free and decentralized, and to create potential true change—not Obama brand Wall Street prepackaged change, but true change—then financial independence and no support from foundations are essential. And part of financial independence, which I explain, is not merely just getting your finances from the people, grassroots, donations, etc., but also by making the amounts publicly knowable and explaining where the money is going. Because the last I heard, Occupy Wall Street specifically had over $300,000. But there's no indication necessarily of where this money is going, and it seems to be starting to organize. And even professionalize around this, which is a little worrying, but it's a good thing that the movement is still quite decentralized.
Now, your third point is one I want to talk over with you about, do not align with political parties. I think that given the lock that the two parties have on the system currently, unless we are able to really write a new constitution, And that's a possibility. I don't want to rule that out. But my concern is that pragmatism needs to set in at some point, and that the Occupy movement will have leverage with political parties. Obama is desperate to get reelected next year. And I believe that there is the prospect here for a kind of negotiation to advance the interests of the 99%, and that ultimately it will have to go through the political process. So I understand your admonition here because of the way the Tea Party, to the extent that it was a real grassroots movement for a moment,
yep.
Is completely bought and paid for by the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and related groups. And I don't want to see Occupy end up as an element of the Democratic Party, the way the Tea Party has been merged into the Republicans. But I do believe that in order to rescue the system, at some point you've got to work with it.
That's a fair point. I just don't personally believe in rescuing the system. The idea of, you know, political parties, it's like if you look at, again, 19th century America with all these social movements, immigrant movements, very radical developments among the working and even the disparate middle class in America, the political parties were created to siphon off those movements and to take it from activism and potential radical change into voting. And we can see where that ended up in today's context. That, you know, again, political parties by their very nature acknowledge the authority and the hierarchical structure of our system because they're very much a part of that. And, I mean, of course, there's the concept of, you know, creating a new party, a more radical party, but still, the very fact that it exists as such is an acknowledgement, a legitimization of the authority that exists.
Right. I guess I'm the most radical one here between the three of us because I would say absolutely not. I mean, as much as I hate and I wouldn't want any effect from, you know, the Koch brothers, same thing with the MoveOn.org and Soros. And negotiating and trying to play it off with Obama, I mean, I thought we have already done that, Peter, before the last election. And we got all the promises and that was the, you know, the supposed change people were going for or they had bought into and they went and, you know, they voted for him.
Okay,
and,
but
I mean,
if we're going to
negotiate with this.
I understand that frustration, but if we are going to do anything about the income and wealth inequality that is at the basis of the Occupy movement, it's not going to happen through shaming the rich. It's not going to happen by camping out in 150 parks across the country. It will have to go through some sort of governmental process, and that's where, at some point, I believe, this movement has to become political.
Well, I mean, I'm going to let Andrew answer this, but I'm kind of more leaning towards the people in the middle that are kind of more libertarian-leaning on this, because I think by having the government in it, which it has been for 100 years, we have gotten this.
Mm-hmm. Well, the movement is political, but it's not co-opted yet or directly engaging with political parties. But I guess my the fundamental issue here is your concept of change. Like you mentioned, changing the wealth disparity, these issues. Again, I see wealth disparity as a symptom. It certainly has many causal factors in terms of all the reverberations throughout all of society that wealth disparity causes from war and poverty, et cetera, but I still see it as a symptom of the larger problem, which is the problem of the institution itself. And I'm speaking for myself here, and I see the institution as being the central problem, not for America, not just for modern time, but through human history. And the idea of aligning with that system or creating new institutions, it just promotes the sort of reformist, very slow, evolutionary, incremental changes to the system, which don't truly address the fundamental issues. Like if the Occupy movement engages with political parties, and I think you're right, I think it will, they already seem to put out a list of demands, demanding that the next whoever's elected next meet their demands, and if not, they'll form a new political party to, I guess, run 4 years after. But, you know, the idea is that to engage with political parties, I mean, from my perspective, the parties are there to divide people, to segregate them,
right,
and to serve the interests of the 1%. I don't see, personally, the point in asking the 1% to change the system that created the 1%.
Exactly.
Because I don't think they ever would. I think that they will use the rhetoric. I think that they may implement reforms. Like you see, you know, Soros spoke up in favor of the Occupy protest. But if you look at his statement very carefully, it's amazing just how straightforward he says things. He says, you know, I support the Occupy movement because, and then he says, they want this. So it's not I want this, it's they want this. So suddenly he knows what 99% of the people want, being a very small faction of a very small semi-percentage of the 1% that Soros is. He says that they want tax, you know, reform, they want Wall Street reform, they want, you know, these specific legalistic reformist changes, which is great for Soros because he can then speak for them and help promote those changes to secure the system. Because what Soros doesn't want and what the parties don't want, whether Democrat or Republican, Obama, Bush, whatever, it doesn't matter, what they don't want is for people to question the legitimacy of the party system itself, the legitimacy of the government, the legitimacy of the banking system themselves. You can promote reform, you can promote changes, but you cannot question the legitimacy of the existence of that system itself, because then their entire wealth, the wealth disparity that they rely on, the power that they have, all of that will be seen as essentially an illusion, and that one which is not just, not right, and should be acknowledged as such. And when people wake up to the fact that, no, the power structures are not legitimate, then it's not about demanding them to give you back power. It's simply about creating something new. Because you cannot demand from anybody else except yourself. And that's sort of my fundamental idea within these points, is that you can only demand from yourself. And so instead of giving a list to the powerful and saying, please change the way you behave, just change the way we behave. So instead of becoming dependent upon the system, start creating new systems, community organized, globally interactive, education. I think education is central, because we can't move forward unless we have mutual ground to stand on, that we can all move forward together, because we remain very segregated and isolated from one another, and that needs to change.
And that just reminded me of a piece I read on WikiSpooks a couple of days ago by unwelcome guest speaker Kevin Annett, so I thought I'd read it to you to conclude the show. Reset this. Why has the second coming boiled down to a check in the mail? An irreverent poke at the New Age baffle-gab that has fooled many. By Kevin Annett, from the 1st of April, 2015. He begins with two quotes. The first from Michel de Montaigne. Men are insane. They cannot make a worm, yet they create gods by the hundreds. And the second is a Zapatista slogan from Chiapas, Mexico, 1994. We don't want money. We don't want power. We want a new world. I haven't any idea what keeps getting sprayed in our atmosphere, but my buddy Ludwig seems to know. I asked him how he knows. Isn't it obvious what they're doing to us? He replied. Well, no, I mistakenly replied. Who is they? Then Ludwig got angry. Looking up every day, I imagined that the shimmering white streams being spilled all over the sky could be anything from job creation to a cluster of psychopaths' idea of global domination. It could be, but I have no way of knowing. All my friends seem to know the truth about the lines in the sky, even though they have as little proof as I do. That's why we don't talk much anymore. I went away to war when I was 38, and I know up close what man can do. I assume the worst of any government or church, but I still want the proof. That makes me frustrating to all of my former friends, like Ludwig. I've stopped trying to point out to the true believers that 94% of the universe is not only invisible, but undetectable, except, it seems, to the believers. Which brings us to the financial reset. I assume you've heard of it. Any day now, that day has been about to happen for at least 6 years and keeps getting nudged forward in the manner of any millenarian prophecy. Some mysterious and powerful group, alternately known as the White Hats or the Star Family, or is it instead that svelte hunk Vladimir Putin, is going to readjust the global financial system, instantly make vast amounts of wealth available to everyone, cancel all debt, and give everybody justice. That's what the consensus is, at least, among the internet faithful whose faith in the reset is on a par with a devout papist certainty that enough prayers to a dead virgin will usher one into paradise. The details of the reset are necessarily vague, as befits any creed for the desperate and the beguiled. The believers regularly contradict themselves and each other about the details, but they are united by one common tenet of faith, namely, that all we need to be saved is enough cash. And in that sense, the reset cult resembles more than anything a theology for shopkeepers. How sad it is that of all the things to build true faith on and long for, the modern true believer can only hope for his credit card debts to be wiped clean. What a sign of how far we have fallen, indeed, but also how banal we've become. Once our vision of the new age was of Christ returning to restore the earth and mankind to God's own bosom. Today we just want the chance to buy more stuff. I'm hard-headed, I guess, which is why the other day I ignored the lesson gleaned from my previous ugly encounter with ex-buddy Ludwig and gently confronted one of the reset believers over coffee. "It's right around the corner," the believer was expositing to me with an odd gleam in his eyes. "They call it Nesara in the United States, an act of Congress that will free us all from debt slavery. It's all part of the reset." "So, let me get this straight," I replied. "The bankers are going to suddenly extinguish themselves and turn over all their loot care of the U.S. government? Why would a shark suddenly turn vegetarian like that?" Flashing me the same look that my Sunday school teacher had given me when, at aged 8, I asked why God had killed his own son, the believer barked, "It's going to happen, you'll see. There'll be an announcement from President Obama about it, at the same time he announces that the starships have landed." Starships? Now we're getting somewhere. Alien saviors bailing out a doomed humanity is your standard and familiar millenarian Weltanschauung, common to any final days cult, and apparently such a faith in a literal salvation from above lies at the root of the financial reset dogma. After all, that's the way us slaves have been programmed to think since before time immemorial, to look to those above us to do what we can't and won't do for ourselves. We've lived vicariously through kings and saints and popes and messiahs and official experts for 6,000 years, boys and girls, so why stop now? I suggested this observation to my reset friend, and, offering a condescending remark about my ignorance and cynicism, he too stopped talking to me, recognizing, no doubt, that I was simply beyond the pale. To those apparently non-redeemable ears, the reset sounds like some Wall Street smart boy's idea of universal redemption. Or maybe it's simply a corporate spin doctor's redirect of all our growing popular rage and hopes for a new world towards the lowest common denominator of individual self-interest. That has been the general strategy of post-war global capitalism, after all. To nullify the potentially revolutionary group identity of the working masses and alter it into the amorphous, ego-driven mindset of the consumer that will feed the system, not change it. And what else is the reset believer than the latest desperate expression of that bourgeois horror, the individual coal thrown out from the fire, each seeking his own salvation? "Show me the evidence," Noam Chomsky told me in 2002, when we were discussing how to deal with state smear campaigns. That's always my first question to any accusation, or any belief system: show me the evidence. Well, evidence, says the Oxford Dictionary, is, quote, "provable information establishing whether something is true or valid, and which can be used in a legal investigation or be acceptable as testimony in a court of law," unquote. Actual evidence of a financial reset on the scale claimed by believers would include official government or bank documents, correspondence, insider testimonies, or other first-hand proof that black is indeed white, that the corporate capitalist system is about to commit suicide and act completely contrary to its nature and self-interest. I have yet to see any such evidence. If it actually existed, we would have seen it by now, since every system has leaks and competing factions, and nothing this huge could remain so utterly undocumented and secret for so long, if it was real. People believe what they want to and need to believe, and in a time like this, so many of us desperately need to believe that the clearly murderous rulers whom we allow to run the world are suddenly going to become human and nice and beneficently bestow nirvana on all of us without any bloodshed or struggle. Such is the ideology of despair, born of too much world weariness and defeat. Such fantasies and superstitions, like religion in general, are always held to and fed most strongly by those who are incapable of action or struggle any more. People like the resetters. Personally, I don't want the system reset. I want it abolished. And that makes me, and those like me, something more of a threat than the passive "feed me, big brother" dilettantes of the reset cult. Reset this genocidal, rapacious system? Hardly. "Prove all things," wrote my jailed ancestor Peter Annett in a seditious pamphlet he wrote in 1761 that simply asked for proof that Christ had actually performed miracles. From Bridewell Prison in London, Peter commented in a letter to friends shortly before he died, quote, "Reason is divinity taken flesh in us, for nothing that is true can be in opposition to reason. Armed thus, we will drive falsity to the bottomless pit, extinguish pious enthusiasm and superstitious zeal, and raise humanity from the darkness of fear and religious presumption to that truth, noble and provable to the simplest mind, that makes all things good." Unquote. If the new world is indeed around the corner, it won't come in the form of money or any official reset, nor will it be given to us by anyone or anything, especially invisible saviours. It will come from clear minds, awakened conscience, and the love of humanity for itself and our belief in ourselves. Reset nothing. Recreate everything. And that closing note to the show was provided courtesy of WikiSpooks, a website which I regularly contribute to. Thanks to Peter for posting that, and thanks to Kevin Annett for posting the original on his website, kevinannett.com. This episode, like all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests, is available for download on the MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to help with the show, all you need is a clear reading voice. I'm still looking for volunteers. I'm building a team to make a radio adaptation of a YouTube video which has a lot of foreign voices. If you're interested in helping out, you can email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. They'll take the money.